Arthur Gomez, Veal 6. Were the doctors good, Arthur? Did you have good doctors?
We had the best doctors in the world in Kent, really. They were very good. Our doctors were, well, Major Gray was a bit of a scientist, really. When we had this beriberi, owing to eating just rice, he felt that if we had thiamine, it was a cure.
If you had
thiamine, T-H-I-A-M-E-N, thiamine, that is a drug. But in short of that, real death, we felt that yeast would help. And in those days, some people used to have yeast tablets. And we have a yeast tablet, and only was one yeast tablet can make a culture with sugar and flour. And of course, after that, he had a whole yeast culture. And we had yeast parades. We had to line up and drink a couple of mouthfuls of this yeast fermented. And it tastes like nothing on earth. Sour and terrible taste, but it was our life preserving for us. And then we also had injections of thiamine, and we all used to line up in the wall about 20 at a time, and the orderly would come with a bucket of needles, and we would stick the needle into each of us. And the needles were so blunt, you could hear it going to our skin, prick, 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 prick. Because he had a bottle, one fellow would walk in front and with that iodine, and then you see what the spot is, and he'd throw it like a javelin. And then the next one would come in with the syringe and give us the right dose. And the third one would come out and pull the needles out and drop them into the bucket. It had to be done in mass, because we were in the hundreds. But they could hear that needle going click, 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 and your turn is coming, and the sound is closer.
Did you have any news of what was going on outside, of what was happening, say, in the war? Did you get any radio at all?
We had a radio, but I didn't. But of course, nobody would say that they had a radio. It always came as a rumor. And the Japanese made several raids in the camp, and they didn't find the radio. It's because it was a small radio, and they dismantled it each time, and each man hit a part. And when we were told to march up to the parade ground, well, the radio marched out together with us. And they searched, of course they couldn't find it. That's what I heard afterwards, whether it's true or I don't know. But I know that one set was found in the camp, and the major officer in charge of the camp took it and gave it to the Japanese. And everybody called him a traitor and hated him. But afterwards, when we found out that what happened to the people in Stanley, and nothing happened to us in Shantripo, I think I leave that decision to you. I think he did the right thing.
Yes, what happened to the people in Stanley? What happened to them?
They were severely tortured, and some were executed. For spying, which is a crime punishable by death. Now we waited, and we were always very hopeful for the day to come when the end of the war would come.
Did you expect
and
that?
We could feel it coming because the intensity of American air raids in Hong Kong increased. At one time there was always a plane above our heads, an observation plane, we call it Albert. One day, the working party said there were a lot of Japanese ships in the harbor. Apparently they were running away from the American Navy that had sailed into the Chinese Sea. That day...
Would you like a drink?
A 400 plane raid over Hong Kong. It started at 9 o'clock in the morning and up to lunchtime. It stopped about an hour, then it started again until about 5 o'clock. The skies were just dark on the American planes, and they sank everything that was in the harbor. Several of the planes were shot down too. That was the worst raid we ever had, whole day raid. But that was because there were ships in the harbor and they were out to wipe them out. And that they did. One of the previous raids in January was in the American Standard Oil installation at Ranchikok, which was within sight of Shamsun Hoon. And when this planes flew overhead, the Japanese, I'm not sure about the Koreans, Japanese, they panicked. Apparently, they were aware of what an American air raid was like. And a part of our camp was strafed because one of our officers, our dental officer, was shot. He didn't die here. He was under his bed for shelter, and the bullet which hit him in the rear. And he said, "I'll never tell my son of my war wound." We were cheering the sea. Standard Oil going up in tanks, going up in flames, with drums going up in the air and exploding like fireworks. But we weren't laughing the next day or two, because they marched us out there and made us clear up debris, salvage what we could, load them onto trucks, and we worked like dogs, loading trucks, taking all the stuff out, putting the fire out and all that.
But these were signs to you, I suppose, that the war was ending.
Yes.
Was that right? Hopeful signs.
Signs the war was ending. And the closest we got to the end of the war was on the night of the 15th, which was a day that the emperor made his speech, what they call the imperial rescript, to say that they did not surrender, but that they were going to give us all peace. And as the working party marched back to the camp, because by then there was a great shortage of fuel in Hong Kong. The men were going out to dig tunnels in the hillsides for the Japanese to hide all the supplies because of the American bombing. And as they were marching back on the 15th, people told them the war is over. They came back and reported to the commander that the war was over. But of course, we had heard the story about it every month, so we couldn't believe that. So, on this next working party, the next day, the 16th of August, as they were marching back, the ladies of were family. Usually they're on the far end of the other side of the road. But this time they were right next to them, almost marching with them, and said, "The war is over, why are you?" So making And I said, my mother was there, told me the war is over, so it must be true. So I went to the officer and told him, the commanding officer, now commanding officer, I must have proof. Get a newspaper. There must be something in the newspapers. So on the night of the 17th, when the boys came back from the camp, they had a newspaper in which it said of this news that the Japanese had agreed to an armistice. But 15, 16, 17 in camp, we were as tense and nervous as we were on the 7th of December, before the war, before the dinner. Nobody slept. We just mingled around. And there were no lights out. The lights were on all the time. So we knew that something happened. So next, on the morning of the 18th, when the Japanese came to take the muster roll to count us as usual, our commanding officer was at the door, was at the gate, to tell them that he could not enter the British military camp. He turned around to go, and we called them back. We called them back and told them that they want food. This was the happiest moment in our lives. It was the happiest days in our lives. Because he said, well, we have no food. So we said, all right, we have a party to go out, commandeer, but you have one man with us. And our boys went out. Because the Royal Army Service Corps, they could drive anything, they could start anything. They took two trucks and they drove straight to the Peninsula Hotel because we had people who knew where the frozen food were kept. And straight into the Peninsula Hotel, loaded the truck with food and signed for it the name of the British Army and brought the food back into camp. That morning, because we had our muster parade, but our own parade, we all lined up. Our officers took our parade. And that motley band with guitars and what played the national anthem. And they ran the flag up. There were three flags. They ran the flag. And as the union went up in a ball, when it hit the ceiling open, and we all cried. Alison was a man of iron, and he was always stern, but we saw him going down his eyes. Everybody was crying. The Navy, the white ensign was up, and they had the long payoff pennant. They were leaving. It was a wonderful morning, and we embraced each other with tears in our eyes, you know. And the next day, the 19th, where the dance, the band, where the dance and ladies came in, and we threw a party. We had plenty of food for the party. Oh, but those several days, I don't know how we lasted because we didn't sleep. You know, we were so excited, but we were living on nervous energy. We were just walking around the camp all the time. And the Royal Air Force planes flew overhead and dropped a ribbon. And we picked it up and gave it one. And the order was to stay in the camp. And they knew where we were. And help is coming. And also gave us instructions to mark out the parade ground for a target area for aircraft to drop food. So we rushed and got all the blankets we could and put them all on the to form the marks as directed. and American planes flew over and Dakota and dropped commander compo rations for us. Crates and crates of food came in from there. The beautiful sky blue nylon parachutes with these boxes, green boxes of commando compo rations were dropping into the camp there. You know? And then one was a white piece of cloth came flying down. It was tied to somebody's shirt and it was a hammer for us to break. So, well, those were glorious days, and we had plenty of food. And
what happened to the Japanese? Was there any reprisal against the Japanese? Did people want to get to the Japanese? And
oh yeah, well, I know that some of the Royal Army Medical boys were running around with crowbars, singing "Run Rabbit Run," but there were no Japanese in sight. No Japanese in sight. In town, they were mobbed. Some Japanese were recognized in a tram, and he was thrown head first out. Of course, he died instantly. Another jumped into the harbor to escape. And of course, they stoned him when he was in the water. They were hated. Then we stayed in camp until the 30th of August. But now every day was a jamboree night. Nobody wanted to do any work. But they didn't have anyone to do anyway. And we were all happy. We were just planning out. The very first next day we commandeered a launch to take those prisoners to Stanley to meet their wives and their children for the family reunion. Privilege was to those who have families. I didn't go to Stanley because I didn't have anybody there. I had to give my place to those who have families to go. When Admiral Harcourt arrived, he came into the camp, and also some Canadian officers came into the camp. We were all very cheery, and of course then, by that time, we had arranged billets, places for us to go back to our headquarters in Hong Kong. And of course, for trucks and transport. And the Royal Navy were giving out food to all the Chinese because they were starving. Hong Kong had no food. So the Navy was giving out food. One of the destroyers came alongside Naval Yard and was supplying energy for the whole town. Because electricity was also down. Life came back to Hong Kong. The Chinese were marching. Instead of a steady stream going out, now there was a torrent coming back into Hong Kong. And they were coming with poles, with children in one basket, and the worldly goods in the other basket, carrying them all back. It was a very happy sight. A very happy sight. They were all coming back. The population of Hong Kong, which had grown from 500,000 to over 1,000,000, in no time, we were back to the old normal. And food came back, and life came back to Hong Kong.
What was the state of the city? What was the state of it when you returned? Was there much damage, you know, with the raids? And
no, we didn't see much damage. We didn't see much damage. But people were sullen. Poverty stricken. Everything they had was taken away, looted by the Japanese in shiploads to Japan. So they had bought everything, of course. They declared our dollar as worth one quarter of their yen, military yen, which was worth nothing afterwards. And with that, they bought everything they wanted to buy. So they took everything out. They sucked Hong Kong dry. But the British brought back, and the people came back, and UNRWA and came and supplied clothing and blankets and giving coats, ladies' fur coats, all good dresses, winter clothing for the people, because winter was approaching. You know, it was September, you know, coming. They were clothing and warm blankets, Red Cross blankets, you know, that were given out to the people. UNRWA offices were opened up, and things were all running back to normal.
What sort of state were the Stanley survivors in? Did you see people from the Stanley camp?
Yes, I met them.
What sort of?
I was in headquarters office with Neville Thursby, this man who started. He remembered me, and he wanted me as his warrant officer. So I was there in the headquarters with him. It was just the two of us, and we had the civilian staff. And those were wonderful days. I could be seconded to the Hong Kong government, but I preferred to return to my company, because who had paid my wife my salary for all the duration, and I felt that I owed them something to go back to them. And I'm glad I did.
Yes, what company was it, Arthur?
It was the Standard Oil Company. The clothing. We had nothing to wear. There were no tailors or material in Hong Kong.
How about your flat? What had happened to your home?
I went back to my flat, the first thing I did, and at first I was thinking I could hide things under the floorboard, but when I went back to where my flat was, and I went up the steps, I noticed that the steps were just concrete, all the wood plank had been removed today, there was no way, it was just only concrete was a floating plank, and when I went up the steps into my flat, again, only concrete. Even the curtain rails and frame rails, you know, the old-fashioned thing, you know, were all taken away. All the wood was taken away. You know, it was just concrete, because all the wood was used for fuel. The railway, the engine, the tender was. People saw furniture in it instead of coal. They were burning furniture. Some trucks, towards the end, were loaded with whatever it was, and they used manpower, 20 coolies, with ropes to pull the lorry. Because there was no fuel. And this was witnessed and immortalized in oil painting by John Harris from Argyle Street camp, where you could see these lorries being pulled with fruit. John Harris is an architect of Palmer and Turner, the people who built the previous Hong Kong Bank building. And he is now the chairman of the Argyle Street camp in London.
Was there any worry about who would take control of Hong Kong at the end of the war? Who would liberate it and take charge of it?
Yes, a great fear came upon us. It was that Hong Kong would not be British, and that we thought was a rumor, but from what we later understood, it was touch and go whether Hong Kong would be liberated by the British or by another army.
Which other army did they think it might be?
Well, the Chinese army wanted to take over. Chiang Kai-shek wanted to take over. But he was not able to do so because he did not have the transport. He did not have the facility. He had the manpower, but the men couldn't come. And the people in Hong Kong were desperate. And, of course, Hong Kong was defended with British blood. It was something to do with American presidents, but as we had a different president at the end of the war, it was a different opinion that prevailed.
But there was the fear at the time, was there, that the Chinese might take it?
That Chinese might occupy Hong Kong. Because once they occupy Hong Kong, they won't leave. But also, they did not do that because they were engaged in a mortal combat in the north with another Chinese army, the Communist Army. And of course, they needed all the help they could from Hong Kong and from the British as well, so that Hong Kong would be better in the hands of the British.
How soon did trade revive? You were saying earlier, Arthur, how important money is in Hong Kong. How soon did trade revive?
Trade revived instantly. You could go out to the streets where people were selling whatever they had looted was available for sale. People could go and buy a fork or a plate or anything. They were there. And as the people were pouring into Hong Kong, they brought with them all their worldly goods. It didn't take long. People were all bartering and changing. And of course, the Japanese currency was still, the military yen was still being used by some quarters. Of course, they took a chance because there was a rumor that they might be recognized.
What happened to the Japanese? Did you see any Japanese about? Where were, you know, what had happened to the Japanese?
It was the most glorious sight because the Japanese were assembled like we were assembled, but they were not marched down in front of people and made to be humiliated. They marched down to the pier and then marched to Central Pool with all carrying their chattels along with them. Some were marched into Whitfield Barracks, which is now Kowloon Park in Jinsha Road. Others were marched to Central Pool. And they were shipped by the Navy back to Japan in a very short time. People didn't keep them here.